Well, great, Daddy. Thank you so much. Funnily enough, it's funny how things converge because just today I helped another programmer interview Al Cooper.
Oh, how interesting.
It just worked out because he's going to be coming out here to play a couple of gigs, and
Yes, I heard about that.
yeah, so just worked out today. So just I came back from that this this afternoon, and so it's wonderful to have two of
I was
the
thinking of
blue.
starting a group with him
Oh.
eventually, called the Blues Rejects or something like that. How's it going again?
The Blues
So some
Rejects.
kind of group. Some kind of group. I don't know. Maybe we'll record in 1965 and go on from there, you know.
Well, it seems like a good idea. I think we can
You
wind
think
things
it'll
back to make that
sell,
happen.
though? You think it'll sell? I don't know.
Well,
It's hard to know.
you never know. I mean, call it the, was it the Jewish Beatles, and you never know what
Jewish
might
Beatles is
happen.
good. I like that one. That was a good one. But, well, whatever.
But
Anyway.
well, should we like start from the beginning? How did you get into music? How did you play, the guitar so well? What
I was
inspired you?
depressed. I was very depressed, and
Okay.
so I took piano lessons. That didn't get me out of depression. It got me more into it. It was classical music, and at the time, I believed in my soul that classical music was a conspiracy to make me practice on the piano with a piano teacher who I found not in the least bit attractive, and she was my mother's age anyway, so it was a no-no. So I didn't like classical piano, but a couple of years later, I'm goaded on by a group sing at these left-wing summer camps where Pete Seeger would come up once a year and teach us, American folk songs and songs in praise of various socialist paradises
And building
abroad.
dams and things, yeah.
Yeah, dams. Yeah, mainly dams. Yeah, and anyway, we'd. But I learned a lot there. I love to sing, and I took up the guitar to accompany myself starting out. And being a somewhat depressed and coming from a little bit of a contentious scene at home, and loving rock and roll and the blues when I heard it first on records. We had some Lead Belly records and some. And Pete and the Weavers did some of that stuff, and Big Bill Brunsley and Josh White we had at home. We had those records, and Mahalia Jackson gospel music record, which set the seed for a little later on spiritual development with me. For her first record, which was no choir, you know what I mean? Just a great rocking band, the world's greatest gospel singer, great record. It all came together. I was like the first generation listening to rock and roll, Elvis and Little Richard and Jerry Lewis and Buddy Knox and the great Chuck Berry, who I admired, still my favorite guitarist, I think. And
Really?
so I was learning. I liked the blues, and I played it on acoustic. And soon after I started to play acoustic, I got a little electric pickup after I got in camp from one of the counselors and bought it off of him and a little amp. And so as soon as I was playing acoustic guitar, I was playing electric guitar at the same time. And the blues made sense to me emotionally in every kind of way. I didn't think about looking in the mirror and determine was I the correct color, liquid correct color to play this stuff. I just felt it. I felt it big time. It was in my reality immediately, and I never looked back.
Wow, did you like play along with the records to learn them? How did you
A little bit, but I sort of got the impression of the stuff that people were doing, and I played with and my colleagues down at Washington Square Park too, starting in the 50s. But they all were playing. But yes, we learned from records. But in my case, I didn't replicate them exactly because that wasn't my thing. And indeed, my guitar style ended up as I believe, kind of an unorthodox guitar style, both acoustically and electrically. I don't sound like anybody particularly. I sound sort of like myself.
Well, and, that's what you want, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's yeah, I guess fair enough. Okay.
Yeah. But oh,
so
yeah.
I went to down to Washington Square Park after hearing Dave Van Ronk on the radio and one day, and I was very impressed. I thought, gee, this guy is some kind of, by the way, I don't know where he's from, you know, which part of South Central Los Angeles or Harlem, or maybe he's actually an Ofe like me.
Yeah.
But I went down to the Washington Square and I found out he was an Ofe like me, but not of the same religion. He was a Scots-Irishman from Queens. And he sure could sing the blues. One less style, and he had a very original sound. He didn't sound like he was imitating anybody. No, like Bobby Dylan, he didn't imitate. Bob started out with Woody Guthrie, but he didn't imitate Woody Guthrie, really. Mm. He took from him and integrated even at the very beginning, I believe. And then just was like a buzzsaw voice, you know, and great. Oh. Early David Van Ronk on the early years on Smithsonian is just fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, always great, but I like that stuff almost the best. It's the blues stuff, and it's what a wonderful musician and a wonderful friend, and he was my mentor. And I took lessons from him, and for about 1/12 of what I charge now. Yeah, it's a strange world. It's strange. Getting stranger.
I hope so. You know, we're doing it too dull, I suppose.
No, never a dull moment.
But like in those days, like in the 50s, you just could wander down to Greenwich Village and just find Dave Van Ronk and, you know, just hang out or whatever. Was that the way it was?
Well, no, you had to call him up for lessons and you paid money for it.
Oh, okay.
You can't just, he didn't want any kid from the suburbs hanging around his scene. I mean, there was heavy stuff going on down there. They were plotting. He was the anarcho-syndicalist. They were, you know, planning the next action and handing out pamphlets and playing serious folk music with older people than me who had actually seen life. I was a beginner in life. You know, they showed me the way to go and also, if I may say so, the way to not go in certain ways. You know, I mean, we all love our mentors. Then it comes the time to, you know, open up the trash bin and, you know, kick them into it. Not literally, of course. It's far be it for me to kick Dave Van Ronk into a trash bin. But, I mean, you have to go on to your own terrible mistakes, you know.
Right.
Well, which, you know, the landscape, as you get serious and more serious, gets littered with your own terrible mistakes. And so I'm one of those mistakes, but I have fun.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care what they say. I'll live as a blonde or as a bald man, which I am now.
You know, the thing is just to keep creating. Nothing else matters. That's really it, ultimately.
Well, I mean, some things do matter. I mean, there are a few other things, you know, War and Peace. I can mention pants, wearing pants when it's a cold day. That's important. New York is very cold now. Very cold.
Some people go without, yeah.
without, within. I don't know. Go within.
I know. I always remember once at school, they did a question about what is addiction, and one of they listed like, you know, tea, you know.
You can't shoot up tea.
I know, it was tea and heroin. Then they put in they put in trousers, you know.
What?
They put in trousers on the list. And I
trousers. This is a case to be made out for that. Listen, I mean, anything can be an addiction, which is what you just said. How dare you repeat my word before you said, I said, anyway, I'm a little confused. I'm getting older, you know?
But that's good. That's
old is good. Yeah, it's the new, I don't know, it's old. It's just what it is.
Old is the new young.
Old is the new young. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I never thought of that. Yeah, try that at a party, you know?
Yeah.
Therefore, you get there. Yeah,
but you know, you must have. I mean, you came into the, you know, the village in the 50s and early 60s. I mean, what a party that must have been. Look at that blinding talent.
Well, yeah, it was good, good and bad.
With.
I mean, there was people on the scene, I don't want to say names, who were, you know, hard drug users already. People mean heroin and cocaine, and wasn't all pretty. Young people's lives already were wrecked and destroyed or on the road to it. But there was a lot of good stuff, you know, a lot of vitality. It was the beginning of the good aspects of the movement, and you know, there's a lot of good stuff, good vibrational energy, you know.
And it's interesting how, you know, I'm from England, obviously, and how the British, you know, got that, you know, plucked the blues from America, and then, you know, just jammed it back down America's throat, and America had to like follow up almost, didn't they?
It's not quite that simple. I mean, a lot of us here were happening at the same time as the British were, or even a little bit before, and American music was what the British, you know, if you go back one step farther, the American music was what the British, you know, took from, you know, the initial. But I mean, I think that the British made a contribution, you know. I never denied it. They shouldn't have, you know, tried to force their way of life down us in the Revolutionary War. But, that, you know, that's a small thing.
When you look back, it's pretty small, yeah.
It's tiny. We'll never forgive you. Never, ever.
Oh, thank you very much.
No, it's cool. Hey, what's the little thing? Like that. It's okay. No, I like
really
that. I mean, I like, yeah, I mean, I like, yeah, I think there's a lot of good stuff. I liked on that blue series that, what's his name, did that?
Oh,
six
Burns? Burns?
Martin Scorsese did.
Oh, the Scorsese one, yeah.
Yeah, I really liked that jam session with Tom Jones and Jeff Beck. That was real good. And what's his name, Van Morrison. That was creative stuff. That was good stuff.
Nice combination. I like that.
Yeah, that was good.
Wow, that's nice. I like those type of where you mash people together and see what happens.
Yeah. I've always liked that. But my heroes were I think. With Tim Harden, Dave Van Ronk. By the way, I have an article out, my first one. It's sort of drawn from my memoir, writing memoir. It's in Fretboard Journal for fall 2009, current issue on page 12. And it's a memoir about my influences in the village in the 60s. And it's about Dave Van Ronk and Tim Harden and the Reverend Gary Davis. And a little bit about the Bruce Langhorne and Michael Bloomfield. Mm. And it's the first bit of writing I've ever had published, really, I think.
Oh. Oh, interesting.
And I think it gives a picture of some of the influences on me. And, you know, my process is a little bit like Dylan's process in that I take a lot of stuff in and then it goes into a mixer inside. And then I add things to it and it comes out like... Tim Harden's version of You Can't Catch Me impressed me a lot when I heard him do it. And of course, Chuck Berry's version was the basic one. And then when the Blues Project did it, we added a little bit of my energy to it and the band's energy and came out with our version of it. And you know, Muddy Waters is very important. You know, but it's all been interesting because there's so much great music out there.
Well, that's it. You had such a rich basket of music to pluck gems from when you were starting.
Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Muddy.
It was a paradise of music, in the early 60s, mid-60s, and 50s, too. I mean, Van Ronk's years at the Square, Washington Square Park, you know, with Roy Berkeley and, you know, Barry Kornfeld and... you know, Seeger would come down there sometimes, Pete Seeger, and, you know, New York City Ramblers, and having access to being actually hearing the Reverend Gary Davis, the greatest musician, I think, of all of us.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was like a guy singing opera while playing a Segovia-level guitar at the same time.
Mm.
What's better than that?
That's stunning, yeah.
You know what I mean? Who else would do that?
Yep.
That's pretty good.
That is a good point. But now, so, you know, you were going in and out of bands and doing solos, but
not really. Well, I mean,
how did you?
I was adrift, like a lot of us drifters at that time. I was adrift, you know, experimenting in leftist politics, doing this or that, you know, playing some guitar, thinking I wanted to be a college student and, you know, take on the world from academia, you know, or something like that. You know, folly, you know. But anyway, I got involved with Van Ronk. What? Yeah.
It was idealistic, you know, that's what we were.
Well, yeah, or other words for it, you know. Maybe there were more than a few on all sides of it. You know, but it was a time and place. It was the sweetness in the air, and there was a lot of good, great stuff happening, and a lot of the stuff that you might modify later on. How should I put it? But anyway.
Yeah, things that you Yeah, things you wouldn't want on YouTube now, let's put it that way.
Yeah, like for instance that, or you wouldn't want any, you know, close relatives to know about it, though they probably did the same thing.
Right.
But, you know, hey, it's madness, but it was fine madness, and some of it wasn't so fine. But, anyway, but you know, I got drifted into Van Ronk's jug band. He was putting together a jug band because it was a jug band mania for a while. Questkin had started this jug band, it was popular, and so they put together his, which had some wonderful musicians in it, and put out a great record, which has never been on CD.
Oh.
And I don't know why, but it's on Mercury, and it wasn't recorded great, but there's some great stuff on there, some rags, you know, from... like a traditional ragtime music plus jug band stuff on all their parts of it. It's kind of a mixture and a little kind of a few jazz tunes to Everybody Loves My Baby and some of Dave's best singing. And I just, it was a wonderful record. I play it all the time for people, you know.
Mm. Yeah, he never made it big, did he, in terms of like all the others who came through the village at the time?
No, Dave should have made it much bigger than he did. But I think that, I think it was a tragedy, and it was probably, in a way, the way he wanted it, in a way, the way he absolutely didn't want it. Who's to say how people's lives turn out, you know?
Right.
It's hard to know. And it just... The Blues Project, I'm convinced, should have made it much bigger than it did. We never made any money, really. And we didn't become a major act. But we've left a historical document in our music, and that's the main thing.
Well, it lives for, you know, that's the thing. Nowadays, it all lives forever. And
That's
the beauty. You know, a kid picking it up
Bessie
now.
Smith we have Bessie Smith in our homes. You know, we can listen to Bessie Smith in our homes. I mean, what's better than that?
Exactly, and a young kid, you know, pimply-faced little nerd can listen to the Blues Project now, and it's all fresh and new.
Sure, and you use it, and because they're spherical, you can use it for coasters or put a marijuana cigarette near the edge, if you dangle it over the edge, it's almost, anyway.
That'd be very prosaic, I would say, yeah.
What's that?
Very prosaic, I like that.
No, but I'm proud of the Blues Project. Very proud of it. I think we did a good thing.
So how did it come together?
Well, it was a rough period in my life, and went through it. And in rebuilding my life, I was staying at home at the time, and I just got the idea, first of all, that I wanted to get back to playing some electric, which I had done in high school. Before I went over to playing acoustic pretty much exclusively.
Hmm.
I went up to the college where I played with Marshall Brickman and Paul Prestipino and John Harold. No, John wasn't there that my year. He was the year before, but the great bluegrass banjo player, and Marshall Brickman.
Oh, yeah, another name.
Later went on to write Annie Hall and all that stuff.
Hmm.
But anyway, I wasn't playing electric then. But in my after my my rough patch in my life, I sort of wanted to get back to trying out electric. It was in the air. Dylan was rumored to be going electric, and
right.
The English were coming in, the Beatles, and I was interested. So I had a famous New Year's Eve party at my house where my cousin Peter, who is now timpanist with the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota, I'm not sure which.
Oh, yeah.
But he came over and played some drums, and I set up an electric guitar, and my friend Roy Blumenfeld, later to become the drummer of the Blues Project, was there. My brother was there, who's also a very fine musician. And some guy played piano, and we played some rock and roll blues that whole night. And excuse me. And then a month or two later, I moved out and back to the city. And I ran into Roy one day, Roy Blumenfeld. He was living in the Lower East Side where I was living. And we thought about maybe doing a gig together. I got some opportunities to do something at a place called Cafe El Toro. So Roy and I, and a guy who played maracas, I think he got us the gig.
Oh, wow.
Stones and Muddy Waters and Slim Harpo tunes over at this place. It sounded pretty good. And then Roy knew this bass player who was slowly dropping out of school at NYU, where Roy was going. Andy Kohlberg, who played stand-up bass. And so we got him on board, and at the same point, Tom Flanders, who called himself Tom Jones at the time.
Oh, no.
I wonder why. was looking for me from Cambridge, where he'd been in a group, and he was an exciting rock blues singer. And he came down to New York to search me out because he heard about me and wanted to start a band. And so Tommy sounded great. So he became the lead singer. I had done some singing too, but I just did a little bit now. And Tommy took on the most of the singing. He was very exciting too because he could do splits on stage, you know?
Oh, wow.
Very good looking. He was something. He was a piece of work. I mean, at one point, MGM brought us out to Hollywood because they were going to try to mix the American Stones. You know?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, could have happened, too.
Whoa.
But that's the point at which the band broke up, except that it didn't break up. Just Tommy left the band, and we, for his own reasons, I don't know, we can remember exactly why it happened, but we went along with Tommy, and the band reconstituted itself and came back to New York just to decide to try it with Cooper singing and me singing and Steve Katz singing, and it went over good. So we soldiered on, as you say.
Well,
and anyway, so we got Al Cooper through the A&R man that I think we did our first demo for Columbia. But Tom Wilson, who had produced Dylan also, African-American A&R man, was moving from Columbia to MGM to Verve Records and the new label Verve Folkway. So I think he took us with him, and in the process we cut a single, which didn't go anywhere, of Violets of Dawn, and Al came on that session as a session man.
Oh, yeah.
And then he decided he wanted to stay, and we liked him. We wanted him to say, we asked if he wanted to stay, and he said yes. And the other side is really a great backdoor, man. Do you have the anthology?
Yes, I do. I've got it right here, yes.
Yeah, Backdoor Man is very exciting. It's an exciting break on there, too.
Very nice. Very nice work, yeah.
Thank you.
I've got to ask, you know, how come so many K's? In the band.
Well, I mean, K is for kosher. We all use. Tommy wasn't. Tommy was an F, so
right.
That was the F word. So we couldn't use that in public. We lost a lot of credibility because you couldn't. No, that's not true. I'm not telling you the truth here. Oh well,
hey, you're meant to be spinning tales for us. You know
what?
You're meant to be spinning tales for us.
Spinning Tails. Yes, Tails. Think of that.
Yeah.
I'm so, really from Dylan's hometown, Duluth. Isn't that the original one?
yeah.
The one in New Mexico.
Duluth, New Mexico. Yeah, I know.
That was something. The original story. I forget. Anyway.
Yeah. Hibbing. That's it. Hibbing. Yeah.
No, Hibbing was his real hometown.
His real hometown. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. the first one that was the not real hometown was something else.
Oh, okay.
Anyway,
so yeah, I mean, you started your first that was what, 64, 65 you were
65.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was pretty early for that sort of heaviness of blues.
Yeah, it was early. It was early, but around also at the same time, which had been started a little earlier than us, even was the great Paul Butterfield Blues Band,
right,
with the great Butterfield and the great Michael Bloomfield, and they didn't take us too seriously for a long time until we finally got on the same bill with them, and then things were a little more equaled out. But they were, you know, they were sensational. Everyone gave them all the due as being sensational, but we had our fans, and there was a certain buzz about us too.
Yeah.
Though I was a very unorthodox player, Michael was more of a Chicago player, but a souped-up Chicago player. He was like, he was like the son of the zeitgeist from Chicago, and he was sensational. He was my hero. You know, I loved him. I loved Michael Bloomfield, still do.
Yeah,
and he's a wonderful player. And together, you know, Butterfield's harp, you know, great Butterfield and Michael. You know, I mean, this is heaven. You know,
that was a. A hot band, yeah.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Well, now, when you went head to head, say, did you feel competition, like you really had to outdo them, or how was that?
Do you know the word knife?
Yeah.
Do you know the word jugular?
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, I think on both sides it was like that, but by the second night, it was... Both bands were playing so well that it became evident that competition was not the point. And here's the point, the great story that came out of this. For two nights, both bands burned, and they burned brightly. They were wonderful. You know, one band would get up and do a great set, the other band would get up and do a great set.
Yeah.
And the third night, after the last set, they had a jam with both bands coming up on stage.
Uh-huh.
And I tell you, first the two drummers would get up, then the two bass players would get up, then Elvin would get up, Steve would get up, Steve Katz and Elvin Bishop, and then I guess Hal and the other guy in the band, in Butterfield's band, and what's his name? Mark Naftalin.
Oh, of course. And, oh my God, yeah.
And then Butterfield, I think me and Michael were the last two guys up there.
Oh.
And we're all jamming away on the blues, and this is a cosmic moment, and this is part of my belief in God.
Huh.
At a certain point, no one planned this. No one said it should be. But all of a sudden, both bands started spontaneously playing the age-old New Orleans, you know, standard that they play, you know, after funeral, signifying the new life is being born and new happiness is available even in the face of death when the saints go marching in.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how it ended. It was very warm. It was beautiful.
Ooh.
Interesting.
You know,
because competition is never the point in music. And cutting contests are really not the point either. It's a question of you're playing to celebrate something.
Exactly. And obviously the crowd are there. Anyway, egging you on.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I think the crowd just enjoy both bands, really.
Yeah.
I don't believe in any of that crap, you know. Though when I was in my 20s, I certainly did. But in a way, yes, in a way, no. I mean, When you read, when you really go in front of greatness, whether it's Michael Bloomfield or, you know, anybody of your contemporaries who's saying the same age, mm-hmm. First of all, with me anyway, and I think Michael felt this about me in a certain sense too. You take a bow first.
Mm.
That's the first thing you do.
Oh, okay.
And because you know, there ain't nothing new underneath the sun. We're all part of listening to records and playing with other people, and you know, without Muddy Waters, without Charlie Patton, without Elvis, there'd be no audience for this rock and roll blues that we tried to do. Without, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's all a chain of being. So.
You're standing on the shoulders, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing, yeah. So it's the acknowledgement beforehand. Well, all that came beforehand, yeah.
Yes, that's key, mm-hmm. because it makes you, none of us are going to be here very long, but you try to make use in the most positive way of your time here.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so in the... You know, when taking those basic blues songs and tunes you did, were you knowingly just trying to create something different, or just in the process you created your sound?
It was the process. It was the process, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like with Two Chainz Running, we just had the basic Muddy Waters tune. I guess it was Catfish Blues. And we just played it every night for a year, and it expanded and turned to an 11-minute piece, almost a symphonic, but still with the balls, you know, and turned to something else. And so all of a sudden we invented a form in a way that, at least for that one song, mm-hmm. that included something in the original, but something was also different. Butterfield's band was more traditional in a way, except for maybe something like East West, which was basically a jazz jam.
Mm. Interesting point. Yeah, they stayed more within the bounds. Yeah, I can see what you mean. Yeah.
And then then the other thing I think that we did that should be heard in the electric form, where Andy uses the devices. A lot of the devices that Hendrix used, or also the people using technology, was the electric flute thing on Live at Town Hall, which is a hard record to get.
Oh, yeah.
But not the original, not the regular flute thing, but the electric flute thing. Where Andy, it's available on this with on Monterey Pop, one of the outtake DVDs on the box set of Monterey Pop. But Al wasn't with us at Monterey, so you can't really hear what it sounds like on the record live at Town Hall, which was not recorded at Town Hall. It was recorded, really, that one was recorded at Stony Brook
College.
Yeah. But Andy's use of, I call it a trip, you know, from heaven to hell. It's like, William Blake or something like that. It's an incredible journey that he uses all these devices and his super technique and his jazz sense, his classical music and psychedelic understanding of the universe, really, and quotes birth and rebirth and death, really, as far as I'm concerned. One of the heaviest moments of the 60s, to me.
Yeah, it's nice, you know, putting in other things like flute, you know, that was a nice twist, wasn't it, to, to create a whole different feel.
Yeah, but I'm speaking specifically of this version of the flute thing.
Yeah.
This one you have to hear that's on Live at Town Hall, because it goes way beyond the original version of the flute thing electronically. It takes it way into something different.
Mm.
It's not the same thing.
Well, was that a spontaneous thing or something he'd worked on and then it just came
he'd
out?
He worked
that
on
day,
some of it. He'd pre-recorded some of it. He had this device that he used, the electronic device on stage. And he was a genius too. He just he created a whole, you know, like Hendrix in his way, using devices to express much more than stylistic level understandings of music, but a deeper level.
Right, exactly. That wonderful creativity, taking one thing and making another. You know.
Yeah. outstanding.
That is the beauty, you know, beauty of it. And how did you like? Did you all, you know, when you worked on, say, you're going to do an album or something? Did you all get in a room together, or did you work out stuff and then come together? How was that process?
Well, mostly, Projections was made, I believe, in 9 hours.
Oh my!
I believe that the whole album. We came off the road. We were hot as a pistol. Huh. And we've been on the road for a while, and we just cut it. It was all in the same room. I think maybe a single, No Time Like the Right Time, not one of my favorites, was made in the old, in the new, old new, you know, overdub technical way, but I think it didn't have one. As much life to it as it could have had. It was better than the production. Al rightfully understands that it wasn't produced as well as the song maybe would have needed. So, but anyway,
yeah, because that was his.
Yeah, we were a live band, and we could bring that into the studio. Though today we would have much better sound. But I still think that there was a quality of. Like when Dylan simplified on Time Out of Mind with the amps and stuff like that and the way it was recorded, it gives a living presence to the experience that oftentimes is lost through too much technology and too much compartmentalization.
Yeah, it clouds it over, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, very, very true. But now, you did some of the biggest, all the big gigs there were. What I mean, you did the Fillmores, did Monterey Pop. I mean, you did some incredible
some of them. The Monterey Pop was a sad occasion because Al had left the band, and we were working with a keyboardist who we didn't work with for too long, who was okay, but it didn't. It was, we were all mad at each other, as groups do. We were like a family, the Blues Project, and one of us had left, and we resented that, and he resented us, and he was deputy state manager out at Monterey Pop, and it was just a sad occasion, And so I was depressed, because I was the founder of the Blues Project, really the founder.
Yeah.
And it was like my dream was over, and kind of I knew it.
Yeah, that sweet moment, that it all the bits came together, yeah. And you felt
that was over with. Yeah. Monterey was the end of that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's interesting. When Al did, I know that there's a couple of different versions of that. I think Al did say that whether he was being polite, he did say that he had. That it was the band, the band didn't want the horns and that created the schism. But
in a way, that was true. A couple of things were true. That was true in the sense because I was going toward a Blood, Sweat, and Tears concept, which was not what the Blues Project was about. That was more of a, that I was taking from his background in arranging with his background as a songwriter, a commercial songwriter. And also his interest in R&B, he was going toward what became Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which was obviously not what the Blues Project was.
Right.
And the fact that he would leave for that is totally justified.
Yeah.
He had a different concept than sort of what I wanted to do myself, but I was starting to get depressed again. So no one else was writing songs except for Al, Steve a little bit. The band was losing its vitality. We're not being managed particularly well, to keep a band going when it's got heavy momentum, and then it starts to lose momentum and doesn't seem like it's going forward. It gets to be like a job,
Right.
And there was that sense, and I think that if I had tried to write some songs, if I wasn't starting to myself. Maybe I was smelling what was in the air because I don't believe that, Steve and Al were talking about this or anything openly.
Yeah.
But I have no problem with them leaving the band. at that time, but mm-hmm. to me it meant that the idea that we could have become, for instance, perhaps a mixture of the Grateful Dead and Charlie Mingus's Jazz Workshop and a serious jazz group, and take on Muddy Waters' work farther in a different direction, and explored 50 other areas, might have been interesting to me, besides, say, a Blood, Sweat, and Tears concept, which is what Al, you know, went toward, which is fine for me, you know, that he did that. But I had other ideas, which I was not in a position to implement, particularly even where I was at the time, though. And to be real, I was not feeling great.
Exactly, you know. So, at the moment, you know, it's all happening. It's so different from sitting.
It's fast, You're a kid too. You know, Al was our experience in the record business, in the business side. I had none.
Mm. So really, you're just groping in the dark, just trying to figure it out. Yeah.
Yeah, we all were to a certain extent, and Al, when he started putting some tissue readers in his book, I mean, it was hard for him. He didn't have any big money to support his concept to live and everything like that. Nobody had it easy, and I don't know. It's just I just know that what we did with the Blues Project did was wonderful music, and that's the point.
Well, and that's it. You know, when I speak to other people, who know blues, and it's all, I mean, you know, whenever, you know, Blues Project gets brought up, I mean, it's always spoke of, you know, glowingly and warmly. I mean, you know, no question. I mean, you really made a huge impression on people. I can tell you that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. But another way, I think we've been forgotten. We've not even been considered for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The money never happened. We didn't have an easy life afterwards, and during the time that we had to get out there so quickly to be seen, that basically nothing came out of it except the most important thing, which was the music being on disc, and that is the most important thing.
Exactly, you know, throughout all the pain and whatever, the joy, at least that's there as that document.
Yes, absolutely, and that's. And my friend John Platt, who is the English guy who wrote the liner notes and put together the collection, Blues Project Young Anthology, a wonderful, wonderful man, unfortunately, who died way too early. What he did was invaluable, because the Blues Project was well on its way to being forgotten.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, it's just... The bright flash, the mayfly.
Yeah, I think it's still a little bit like that, not entirely, but I think that it would be nice to see a revival of interest in the Blues Project. But I'm really interested in my own new trio. We have a new record out. I'm going to live, love, and sing about in my song. Is the title of it on Sojourn Records. And I think that shows some of the development from the Blues Project, some stuff a little similar, some stuff very not similar. And it's kind of a little bit like some pre-Blues Project stuff I did, and then I do some writing on this also, and also some other stuff. So I didn't stop, and I'm very happy with this record.
Yeah, so you're back touring again, doing some gigs?
Yes, I am playing Princeton on Friday, the 18th.
Oh, incredible! What type of reception are you getting?
Very good, very, very good. We played Cafe Lena, got a standing ovation. That was last week, and it's been very, very good. Trio form is good because I get a chance. I'm playing an acoustic electric, but it sounds like really sort of like an electric. And my drummer is Mark Ambrosino, who worked with Ray Charles and Whitney Houston and Stevie Wonder and Temptations, everybody else.
Oh, wow.
And he's also the president of this record company. Sony has taken on the distribution of a number of independent labels, and Sojourn Records is one of them. And, we have high hopes for this record getting out there.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. It's it's a different business world now from the '60s and seventies. Obviously, with technology and iTunes and all those things, that has made a huge difference in the business.
Yes, but I think it's always about the music, about the performance, and about the truthfulness of the performance. And you know, with all that's thin and plastic in the culture now, I believe we don't have to settle for that. Mm-hmm. It's too cheap. And I hope this record will be seen by other people as I believe I see it. It got glowing reviews, about 30 of them in all the major music magazines that deal with this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And this is my contribution to for an older man now, but still involved in wanting to make people feel the way I feel about the goodness of music and its contribution to life.
Yeah, and what's in your soul? I mean, your playing has always had, I mean, remarkable soul in it. I mean, you could, you know, just, you know, you had speed, you had soul, nuance. I mean, you know, that was the key to your playing, I think. It sell a lot.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
On a record, you can have just somebody playing a guitar, but, you know, when you really know that person's, you know, just feeling it, just that difference. It's we know. you listen to enough, you know the difference. That's the thing.
Well, it's been a wonderful thing to play the guitar all these years, and really has sustained me. Been times I doubted I could really be creative again. I've had rough periods, but I seem to have been with the aid of God, and my guitar survived.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's it. You know, life brings those times, you know, those trying times, and definitely, you know, anybody in the music business, that's it's not like a normal business, you know, and so
no.
It can be very trying, you know. To
yes, but most people have a tough time in life, whether it's economic, whether it's raising kids, whether it's you know, whatever it is. Life has many challenges. I don't think it's just musicians who have challenges. I think that the nature of the thing is to have challenges and to learn from them and to become a better person because of the challenges, if it doesn't flatten you. And I think even in situations where things look like the worst, I think there is something that can be regained and refreshed from having a good attitude toward getting through any situation, and I mean any.
Yes.
Because we're supposed to survive. That's the idea, I think. That's why every springtime there's a rebirth. That's why, you know, music is eternal. Now we've got it even on recorded equipment since the end of the beginning of the 20th century, you know?
Right.
So I can't hear arguments. The fatalist argument doesn't make much sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Just no, doesn't.
I think that's what. You know, can you give any advice to people? I know it's tough sometimes, but just, you know, like your experiences, you know, what you wouldn't have done or another road you would have if you'd known better, or is that hard to do?
Well, I'd say one thing is important. Several things I would say, actually. I'd say immerse yourself in many kinds of music that speak to you. Go to the musics when you're starting out, say, being a guitar player or being any kind of musician or singer. Go to the musics that speak to you, but go beyond those musics too. The things, take chances on listening to stuff that you might think you don't like. I know that with my own experience with my father playing classical music around the house, I thought I didn't like it until about 20 years after I left my parents' house. I started buying classical records. Same with really learning about jazz, which I've learned a lot more about and love very much the last 40 years, which I didn't really know about too much when I was coming up. Same with you know, many things. Really try to really go with your bliss, like the guy says, but make your bliss larger than your comfort zone. And but also experiment on your instrument. Don't settle for just imitation of one person's style. Same as I tried to do. You don't want to do that. You want to immerse yourself in that too, but explore things that are a little outside of that, a little different than that, or your own version of that. And mainly, when you feel comfortable and when you've gotten some confidence, the most important thing for a young artist or any kind of artist is to always stand naked in front of your music, knowing all along that you have to kind of realize yourself by being truthful to how you feel at the moment in your music, in your art. It's best to just even find out how you feel. It's not an instant thing, but right. It's just perhaps a voyage of discovery, even to discover how you're feeling, you know, and then not be afraid of saying this is where I am, and to give about a tradition, but not be bound by it, and to do your own music as much as possible without discounting the effect of the great traditions that we've inherited.
Exactly. That's the thing. What a wonderful base to work from. What's been given us.
I mean, yes, absolutely.
Be able to create from that point on. I mean, that is a wonderful thing to do, and to create, give that pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. It's been a very rewarding life. I wouldn't have chosen any other life at this point in my life, and I think I always felt that way. And you know.
Yeah.
I think it's also important not to be a narrow person about anything in your life, to always question your foundation, but have the foundation.
Exactly, and keep learning, I think, is so important, I think, isn't it? As you're doing, getting into jazz, more jazzy stuff, I mean, there is no, you know, something you just have to do because that's what you always did. You know, that's the key.
Yeah, well, it's good. It's good to be free. I think that you know, my generation was a very open generation. I think that not everything was good about the '60s, but there was a lot that was good, and I think that was kind of a step up toward a freer, better world. And I think that music had a lot to do with it, and I think it always will. I think it's more part of things in a way than ever, and I think that we have to be positive.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you can have a sad song, but it's still positive. That's the thing.
Well, maybe that's your song. I don't always have a sad song. I think the blues is more survival music than the sad music, because it says that you can get through, you know, tough times with the song. I don't think that's a sad message. I think it's a happy message. I mean, you know, I think, yeah, I mean, to me, the very fact of 1 second of consciousness with one piece of biscuit in your mouth and a little bit of a roof above you and being in your right mind means that when you open your mouth and you sing a note, you have won. And you don't want to be in a sense that the material is really secondary to the spiritual, but it doesn't exclude the material, and the fight for the material in life is essential, but it's very important when you go for actualizing the full existence of that's available, to not be fatalistic, because you can't win if you're fatalistic. You don't have a chance to win if you're fatalistic.
Right, don't even
and
bother
super
starting.
Hip is not the way to go.
Exactly. Don't even bother, yeah.
Yeah.
But But now you said you've got more into spirituality, or it's been revealed to you more. How did that work?
Well, yeah, I had sort of a mentor on the West Coast when I was living out there. I was living in Oakland for about 8 years, mm-hmm. and she was very instrumental in opening up some things to me. That's all I wanted to say about it, except that I said the Mary Jackson record really opened up something for me also when I was a kid. And the beauty of the black experience and the greatness of the black people as people mm-hmm. is something to be learned from and to be honored and participated in, as far as people are honorable, truthful, and have their own self as themselves when they go to any style of music or any spiritual thing as large and as deep as either the black experience, black music, or Shakespeare.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's not just music or words. There's a whole culture behind it.
But also that culture is so great that it's accessible to everybody.
Very good point.
Shakespeare, or Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Rembrandt or Elvis.
Yeah. I would love to see them sitting down together, chatting.
I'm sure they're doing that right at this moment.
Good point. Very good point. Well, Danny, thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you, Arnold.
Fabulous, and we've really covered a lot of grounds, and I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great talking to you, and say hello to all my friends on the West Coast. And I'll get out there sometime soon, I hope.
Oh, please do. Let us know, and we'll get some gigs going out here, because I know there'll be a lot of people wanting to see you and play with you.
All right, we'll stay in touch.
And really look forward to seeing you when you come out here.
Okay, thank you so much, Arnold.
Okay, Danny.
Take care. You.